Today is Tuesday, November 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. U.S. President Biden says he's sorry the U.S. pulled out of the Paris climate talks under then-President Trump.
We'll demonstrate to the world the United States is not only back at the table, but hopefully leading by the power of our example.
The head of the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on Climate says young people are demanding, not asking, for climate neutrality.
We'll demonstrate to the world the United States is not only back at the table, but hopefully leading by the power of our example.
And a top U.S. official says he's alarmed over new reports of violence near the Tigray region. We'll have those stories and more coming up next. At the UN Climate Change Conference, COP26 in Glasgow, Scotland, U.S. President Joe Biden apologized for the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 Paris Climate Accord under his predecessor, Donald Trump. Biden said the U.S. is now back at the table to lead on climate change. But as White House correspondent Patty Wittig-Husqvarna reports, it's unclear just how much he can deliver.
Climate activists pose as world leaders playing in a traditional Scottish pipe band near the COP26 UN Climate Summit in Glasgow. They say wealthy polluting nations are not slashing greenhouse gases quickly enough.
There they are in a hot air band in Glasgow. What we need is action.
U.S. President Joe Biden is promising exactly that.
We'll demonstrate to the world the United States is not only back at the table, but hopefully leading by the power of our example.
Biden expressed regret that under the Trump administration, the U.S. has been largely absent in global climate talks.
We apologize for the fact the United States, the last administration, pulled out of the Paris Accords and put us sort of behind people.
Developing nations that suffer the worst impacts of climate change want wealthy nations to fulfill their climate financing commitment to help them with $100 billion a year. Biden announced an initiative to provide $3 billion per year by 2024 as part of his broader climate financing package, but it's not certain he can deliver.
I'm unclear whether he has this. Is the backing of Congress to provide assistance to developing countries in meeting climate goals.
On the sidelines, Biden met with President Joko Widodo of Indonesia, a key country in a region where Chinese influence is rising. The Indonesian leader will take over the G20 presidency from Italy in December. From Edinburgh, Scotland, Patsy Wittig-Husqvarna, VOA News.
Nisreen Al-Saeem, the chairperson of the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on Climate, says it's important for young people to be heard at the climate conference in Glasgow because there's no time to waste. The 26-year-old from Khartoum, Sudan, tells me the world's biggest emitters must reach meaningful targets for climate neutrality now, not later.
As a young person and as someone coming from Sudan, we don't really have any other choice but to continue doing this work and to continue pushing for climate justice. I've seen how climate change is impacting our community and how devastating it is for us. So that's why we are trying to continue this work as much as possible.
Well, tell me about it in Sudan. What are you talking about exactly when you say you've seen it up close and personal?
Well, Sudan is a very vulnerable country to climate change, and that's because we depend on natural resources very much. We depend on rain for everything, for our food, for our drinking. So whenever we have too much water, then it's a disaster, and we have a flood, and everything gets destroyed. And whenever we have too little water, then that means it's drought, which is actually threatening our food security, our water security, and of course our economy, because we are an agriculture-based economy country. And I've seen how people are suffering with this variant and instability of the weather that we are actually having and seeing in the last decade.
I know that in Sudan and South Sudan, that the water has always been a big issue, especially trying to access clean water. What kind of changes have you seen in the last couple of years when you talk about climate change?
The only change I can see that more people are starting to be aware of the issue, but how country is dealing with the issue and how is the situation now, I don't see much of a difference. It's very much the same.
What are you hoping to see the world leaders do when you are talking to them directly now at this climate conference in Glasgow?
Yeah, we are not only hoping but actually demanding, because we don't really have more time to waste. And today I was in another interview where they actually projected a small video for a small kid called Susan. She was in Rio Summit back in 1992, and she was saying exactly the same thing we are saying right now. And unfortunately, the leader's response to her was exactly the same responses to her right now. I wasn't born in 1992, and I feel so ashamed to repeat the same things after so many years. And this means that we are still in the same position. We're still in the same spot, and this is really devastating.
How realistic do you think that the targets are that the bigger emitters have set? Do you think that they will stand by them?
Actually, they are below the expectation and below what's needed now to tackle climate change. Many countries, actually only 6 countries, submitted enough NDCs, and unfortunately, none of them were developed countries. All of them were developing or even LDCs who actually doesn't have any emissions, so that why their plans were very easy to reach the target, because they don't have any comparing to the different countries. And if you looked at the UNEP or UNFCCC census report of NDCs, you will see that if they did not keep this, then we are in big trouble, because we are already in trouble with what they submitted, because it's by far below the target.
What do you hope to see at the end of this conference?
We are not only hoping, but we are demanding. There's a lot of agenda items that is not finished yet, and we need to finish it to start actually implementing things on the Paris Agreement. We need to start working on different scenarios and different projections, and wasting time in agreeing on text that no one will actually implement at the end is not really the ultimate way of using the time, the very little time we still have. Last but not least, there's many agenda items that need to come to conclusion so we can actually implement the Paris Agreement, if the Paris Agreement will actually save us. And raising the ambitions is not just the terminology that we use. It's an actual hope of hundreds of millions of people around the world who actually their lives, their livelihoods, their future actually depend on raising the ambitions of the developed countries.
That was Nisreen Al-Saeem, chairperson of the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change, speaking with me from Glasgow, Scotland. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said he is alarmed over reports that rebellious Tigrayan forces have captured 2 towns in the neighboring Amhara region. Reuters correspondent David Doyle has this report.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he is alarmed by reports that forces from Ethiopia's Tigray have taken over 2 key towns. The Tigray People's Liberation Front said on Sunday its fighters were in control of Kombolchar and its airport, having claimed the capture of Dessie the day before, which the government denied. Both are located in Amhara, which neighbours the northern Tigray region. On Monday, Ethiopia's government communication service said Tigrayan forces had summarily executed 100 youths in Kombolchar. TPLF spokesperson Getachew Reda denied the allegation, saying there was no resistance in Kombolchar. An Ethiopian government spokesman did not immediately reply to a request for comment on Getachew's response, but had earlier referred Reuters back to the government statement. Verifying such accounts is difficult, as communications to the area are down and journalists barred. Kombolchar would be a strategic gain for the Tigrayan forces in the nearly year-long conflict with the federal military and its allies. It's located on a major highway around 235 miles from Addis Ababa. If confirmed, the seizure would be the closest to the capital and the furthest south into Amhara that Tigrayan forces have reached since pushing into the region in July. Speaking on Monday, Blinken said continued fighting was prolonging a dire humanitarian crisis in northern Ethiopia. He urged all parties to cease military operations and begin a ceasefire without preconditions. Thousands have died since the conflict broke out, and more than 2 million have been forced to flee their homes.
That's Reuters correspondent David Doyle reporting. Jeffrey Feltman, the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, spoke to reporters from Washington on Tuesday and said he, too, is deeply concerned about the latest events in the Tigray region of Ethiopia.
Without question, the situation is getting worse, and we are, frankly, alarmed by the situation. Whether we're talking about access in northern Ethiopia, in Tigray, or we're talking about increased numbers of displaced in the federal Ethiopian state of Amhara by TPLF military advances, we are alarmed. There has been insufficient access to Tigray since late June, early July. The United Nations estimates that only about 13% of humanitarian needs to the federal state of Tigray have been met, and it's for a number of factors, including fighting, but it's mostly government restrictions, bureaucratic restrictions that have prevented the type of humanitarian access from getting to the people of Tigray. And we see signs of famine and near-famine conditions. There are over 5 million people in conditions of food insecurity now, whose needs could be addressed if the government would allow the assistance to flow. And at the same time, you see the TPLF, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, has moved out of Tigray, south into Amhara, have taken strategic cities of Desi and Kombolcha, and there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Amhara who are fleeing TPLF military advances. So that we're calling on all parties to this conflict to find ways to de-escalate the situation, allow the humanitarian access to flow to those in need, be they in Amhara state, be they in Tigray, be they in a far state, and move toward a negotiated ceasefire. The situation is dire, and as I said, it is getting worse.
Feltman says there are now more than 5 million people that are food insecure in the Tigray region. The U.S. envoy to the Horn of Africa also said the U.S. is encouraging military leaders in Sudan to restore the civilian-led transitional government there. Sudanese military chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan ousted Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok and his cabinet on October 25th. Military forces also fired live ammunition at protesters, killing 11 people. In response, Western states cut off hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to Sudan. A CDC advisory panel meets Tuesday to consider detailed recommendations for administering the Pfizer vaccine to younger children. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The FDA already cleared the shots, and the government is already shipping them. After CDC advisors make their recommendations, the agency's director will give the final order. The vaccination drive is expected to start later this week by giving shots to children, which are free. The U.S. hopes to head off another coronavirus wave during the cold weather when people spend more time indoors. The CDC acknowledges both a sense of urgency and concern about children getting vaccinated, stressing clinical trials found at highly effective with no severe adverse reactions. I'm Julie Walker.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Dam. A group of gunmen and suspected suicide bombers assaulted Afghanistan's main military hospital in Kabul Tuesday, causing a number of casualties. The official Afghan news agency quoted witnesses as saying Daesh was behind the raid, using a local name for the regional affiliate of the Islamic State, known as Islamic State Khorasan Province. A spokesman for the Taliban government said the assault began with a powerful explosion at the entrance to the hospital in the Afghan capital's Wazir Abkar Khan area. The Taliban forces were reportedly battling the assailants inside the hospital. The extent of the casualties were not immediately known, nor were there any claims of responsibility for the attack. Yahoo, Inc. says it is pulling out of China, citing an increasingly challenging business and legal environment. The company said Tuesday that its services will no longer be accessible from mainland China as of November 1st. Yahoo is the second largest U.S. technology firm in recent weeks to reduce its operations in China. Last month, Microsoft's professional networking platform LinkedIn said it would shutter its Chinese site, replacing it with a jobs board instead. Saudi Arabia's crown prince is calling on businesses, their employees, and their families to move to the kingdom. The once ultra-conservative capital, Riyadh, now offers a lifestyle that includes concerts, movie theaters, and world-class sporting events. Cultural heritage sites are also being revamped for tourists, setting Saudi Arabia apart from other Gulf Arab capitals that feature sprawling malls and high-rise hotels. The Saudi investment minister says the kingdom is simply regaining its place and not in competition with neighboring Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. The World Food Program reports successive years of extreme weather events have plunged thousands of people in Madagascar into what WFP officials call the world's first climate-induced famine. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
5 years of consecutive drought, compounded by sandstorms as well as cyclones, an invasion of locusts, and growing insecurity, have created what World Food Program officials call the perfect storm. The latest UN Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, assessment of the food situation in Madagascar found 1.3 million people are suffering from acute hunger. WFP Deputy Country Director of Madagascar, Arduino Mangoni, says an estimated 30,000 people are suffering from famine.
This is basically the only, maybe the first, climate change famine on Earth. If we look at the others, current food crisis, including famine-like conditions, so South Sudan, Yemen, and Ethiopia for the Tigray, they are all driven by conflict.
Mangoni says hundreds of thousands of people do not have enough food and have exhausted their coping strategies. He says many are surviving by eating cactus leaves, insects, and locusts. He says people must walk 30 to 40 kilometers to buy water, which is becoming more expensive. He says some people who have sold everything, their land, their cattle, their household goods, are leaving their villages behind and migrating toward urban centers in search of help. He says about 500,000 children under age 5 are suffering from acute malnutrition. He adds an estimated 110,000 children are in a state of severe malnutrition and in need of special nutritional feeding to survive.
Whenever one enters a nutrition center, the situation is heartbreaking, with silence, no joy, kids just staring at you, and in a situation of really skin and bones.
Mangoni says he's worked in several emergencies, including Democratic Republic of Congo, the Central African Republic, and Darfur. He says he has never seen children in such a lamentable condition as these in Madagascar. In April, WFP was forced to cut food rations in half for 700,000 people because of lack of money. The agency began restoring cuts for thousands of the most vulnerable in September. Mangoni says WFP plans to further scale up food rations for many more people from December until what it hopes will be the next good harvest in April. To support this program, he says WFP urgently needs $69 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
One of the most closely watched elections this month in the United States is the race for Virginia governor, which is considered a bellwether ahead of next year's midterm elections. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Former Governor Terry McAuliffe remains optimistic he'll win a second term.
We're going to take Virginia to the next level.
The well-known Democrat who ran the state from 2014 to 2018 has watched an early lead dwindle to a statistical dead heat with Republican businessman Glenn Youngkin.
Tons of momentum. I mean, I'm not kidding. The momentum in this race is something else.
Early on, Youngkin had embraced Donald Trump's policies, but now has sought some distance. Political analyst Dr. Larry Sabato says the tightness of this race sends a signal to national Democrats.
Republicans will take heart in that and will project this forward, rightly or wrongly, to November 2022, when a third of the Senate, the whole House of Representatives, and 36 governorships are on the ballot.
I'm Jackie Quinn.
The western U.S. drought, the most severe in 125 years of record-keeping, is exacting a toll on communities throughout California's San Joaquin Valley, where people living on the edge of farmland gather many of the crops, but little of the largesse from the state's agricultural industry. Reuters correspondent Brian Wood has this report.
The farm town of Teveston in California's San Joaquin Valley is on the front line of drought, the worst in 125 years of record keeping. Over the summer, when temperatures routinely rose above 90 degrees Fahrenheit, local wells either ran dry or were contaminated with pesticides. Teveston's less than 1,000-person population has depended on supplies of bottled water since June. They live on the edge of farmland, where laborers reap little reward from California's $50 billion agricultural industry. Instead, they bear the consequences of pesticides. Tap water in Teveston has likely been contaminated with the carcinogen 1,2,3-TCP for decades. Esperanza Guerrero is a Mexican immigrant whose husband works at a dairy farm. The poor water quality poses a risk for her 16-year-old daughter, who suffers from gastrointestinal issues.
It's very difficult not having drinking water. I came here from Mexico thinking that this kind of thing would never happen here. And now we are facing reality. If they can't give us clean water in such a small community of 700 people, imagine what it will be like with all of California in a drought.
Teveston won a $3 million settlement over the summer from pesticide producers Dow Chemical and Shell, which will pay for a water treatment plant. While the town waits for that to be built, TCP levels remain well above what's considered safe to drink, and residents still have to contend with a drought, drying up the supply for themselves and the land.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam. After a long day pruning grapes in a rental vineyard, 33-year-old independent winemaker Ian Dai finishes his last batch of harvests for the year on the desert foothills of China's northwestern Ningxia region. Reuters correspondent Libby Hogan has more.
China is a major market for wine, especially for reds, and it's still growing. But its own wineries have had to battle an image problem, with buyers wary of their quality against bottles from overseas. But in recent years, that's been changing. 33-year-old Ian Dai is one winemaker on a mission to find grape varieties that can represent China. He dropped out of university in Sydney and found his passion in wine sales. His quest has taken him to the desert foothills of Ningxia, near the Mongolian border.
So put it in a romantic way, I want to explore the wine China. I just want to see, I want to figure out how different regions taste like, feels like. In Spain, they have similar projects. There are winemakers who make wine all over Spain.
Dai is experimenting with less industrial ways of making wine. He is shying away from changing the taste by adding yeast or adjusting the acidity while the wine ferments. He is proud of his wine brand, Xiaopu. The first batch only sold around 5,000 bottles in 2018 to 2019. But a year later, that number jumped to over 20,000.
As a winemaker, I should have an ego to make the best wine in this planet one day, in the land of China, with a great, we grow in this land. So I think in 20 or 30 years' time, I should make an interesting wine, and it's also super good.
China's modern-day winemaking dates back to the 1980s. Leader Deng Xiaoping had just opened the door to foreign business, and French firms poured money into wineries. By the 2000s, domestic wine had improved in quality, thanks in part to a focus on growing healthier and riper grapes. Wine consultant Feng Yi Walker says Chinese wine seems to be drawing in a wider range of customers.
There are more people drinking wine in China, more people wanting to know about wine. And because they're drinking a lot of international wine, they kind of think, hey, well, what about China? Doesn't my own country make some great wine? So that's one of the reasons it's been growing.
The majority of Chinese wine lovers still reach for reds. And as a side effect, wineries often try to craft Bordeaux imitations. But now they are embracing alternative varieties like Marsalan, as winemakers like Dai experiment and search for China's signature variety.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team and producer Nadia Taha, thank you so much for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.